Thank you very much, and good Sabbath. Got a little more company up here today. It's nice. Thank you. I appreciate the effort that Michelle put into decorating the speaking area here and also the donation that was made in that regard. Perhaps it's been a little difficult, you know, renting a hall where we have to tear everything down every week. We just can't leave everything set up. We are somewhat limited in our workforce here setting up for services, but this is very nice. I appreciate it. It does look nice here and on the video, so hopefully it makes for a more pleasant experience. I know sometimes my messages and looking at me for an hour or less is not all that pleasant of an experience, but hopefully it's helpful to some degree. I want to begin today's message by going over to Genesis chapter 12. Genesis chapter 12. Prayer can be an extremely powerful thing. During prayer, we connect with the supernatural. We speak to the Almighty, Creator of heavens and earth. And the result of prayer, our connection to God in this way, can be extraordinary. And though I think much of the time it might seem like our prayers are kind of a one-sided conversation, God is listening. We are aware of that He is listening, and God often responds. Sometimes the response is delayed, which might cause us to think, is God hearing me? Does He understand what I'm going through? But occasionally, God does respond to prayer suddenly and powerfully. Moses prayed, and the fire was quenched. Elijah prayed to God that it would not rain upon a wicked area, a wicked people of the earth, people that had become wicked, and it didn't rain for 3 years and 6 months. Hannah had prayed that she would give birth to a child, and she gave birth to one of the greatest prophets of the Old Testament. And so on rare occasions, God responds quickly and powerfully. And sometimes God actually reaches out to us and speaks to us without being prompted, without us beginning with prayer. And this was the case actually with Abraham, and then also with his son Isaac, and also with Jacob. So these men, I think, were decent men already. Abraham was likely a person who had good moral values for the most part before God reached out to him. But God spoke to him, and He spoke to Isaac and Jacob powerfully. And the result of this conversation was phenomenal. And so one of these conversations is found in Genesis 12, in verse 1, where the Eternal spoke to Abram and said, "Get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house, to a land that I will show you, and I will make you a great nation. I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curses you. And in you, all families of the earth shall be blessed." And so God's blessing to Abraham, known as Abram at this point, was something that would be felt eventually by all families of the earth. And it was because God had called Abraham for a purpose. And God knew that Abraham would become a faithful man, a patriarch of faith even. And this blessing that God gave to Abraham right here, this promise, it was reiterated to Abram several times, and God expounded on it as He spoke these words again. In fact, in chapter 17 and verse 6, God told Abraham that kings shall come from you. Wow. Can you you imagine God saying that to you? Kings shall come from you. In chapter 22, if you'd go over there for a moment, chapter 22, we have this promise, this blessing expounded upon here, verse 17. God said, "Blessing, I will bless you, and multiplying, I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heaven and as the sand of the sea which is on the seashore. And your descendants shall possess the gate of their enemies. In your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice." And so the promise that God gave to Abraham, it would be fulfilled through Sarah, his wife Sarah, her firstborn, her son Isaac. In chapter 26, we have that account. And then, again, God would reiterate this blessing to Isaac's son Jacob in chapter 28. And so the situation surrounding God restating or reiterating this promise is the thing that I would like to focus on today. And the reason is because the orchestrated event surrounding this promise to Abraham and then to Isaac, and I'm going to focus specifically on through Jacob, it has much to do with prayer, and it has much to do with faithfulness. So if you go over to chapter 28 of Genesis, chapter 28, Genesis chapter 28, and I'm going to begin reading in verse 10. This is after Jacob had left his home and was traveling to meet with a relative, Laban. And chapter 10, Jacob went out from Beersheba. I'm sorry, verse 10, he went out from Beersheba and went toward Haran. And he came to a certain place and stayed there all night, and because the sun had set. And he took one of the stones of that place, and he put it at his head, and he lay down in that place to sleep. And then he had a dream. Behold, a ladder was set up on the earth, and its top reached to heaven. And there the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Eternal stood above it and said, "I am the Eternal God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie I will give to you and your descendants. And also your descendants will be as the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. And in you and in your seed all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Behold, I am with you, and will keep you wherever you go, and will bring you back to this land. For I will not leave you until I have done what I have spoken to you." Wow. And then Jacob awoke from his sleep, and he said, "Surely the Eternal is in this place, and I didn't even know it." And he was afraid, and he said, "How awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven," because of what he had seen. And then Jacob rose early in the morning, and he took the stone that he had put at his head, and he set it up as a pillar, and poured oil on top of it. And he called the name of that place Bethel, but the name of the city had been, or that city had been Luz previously. And then Jacob made a vow, saying, "If God will be with me and keep me in this way that I am going, and give me bread to eat and clothing to put on, so that I come back to my father's house in peace, then the Eternal shall be my God. And this stone, which I have set as a pillar, shall be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will surely give a tenth to you." So the account, this what happened to Jacob, is amazing, astounding. And though the bulk of the miracle we see took place actually in a dream, it was a vision that he had seen, words that he had heard, it was God speaking directly to Jacob, showing him that the message came from God, came from his throne, and that was portrayed by this ladder or a staircase, if you will, going up to heaven, angels coming and going from this up and down the staircase. And God, we see, he reiterated basically the same covenant that he had stated to Abraham and that he had said to Isaac. And I think this was God's way of powerfully affirming to Jacob that this promise would be fulfilled through him. So Jacob called the name of the place Bethel, meaning the house of God. And though Bethel is mentioned in earlier chapters during Abraham's journeys, I think it's likely, and this is kind of a side note, it may be that the author was recording the name of the area as it was known during his time, so people would know where it was. And, Jacob had given the name to this place later. And so Jacob, he was the last man to have these words of this promise that God had made, said to him directly by God. It was said to Abraham several times, we have the accounts. It was said to Isaac at least once, and then we have it being stated to Jacob. And this meant, of course, that the promise would be fulfilled through this man who would later be given the name Israel. And Israel is an interesting name or title. It means God prevails. But this name can also be interpreted as he will rule as God. And that is interesting, because when we read about the 144,000 in Revelation 7, we see that they will be categorized into 12 tribes of Israel, put into 12 tribes of Israel, consisting of 12,000 each. And so we see that the 144,000, they will experience the fulfillment of what Israel can be defined as. He or they will rule as God, and of course with God. Now, of particular interest to this account here is the stone that it says Jacob put at his head. Some translations, I don't know what translation you're using, but some translations will say that he used it for a pillow, that he put it under his head, or that he rested his head on a large rock. My translation, the New King James, says that he put it at his head, so it could be that it was just positioned somewhere near his head. But of course, if he were to lay on it, such as a pillow or using it, none of that sounds very comfortable. Obviously, of course, he could have put a piece of cloth or a cloak or jacket or something on it to make it a little more comfortable. It could work, in any case, as a way just to simply prop up your head when you're sleeping. In any case, Jacob obviously had a particular stone near to his head as he slept, and he was given a vision, and he was given a message directly from God, promising that his descendants would be so numerous that they would spread out around the earth, to the east, the west, the north, the south, like the dust of the earth. We find dirt of the earth everywhere, right? And that's what God was relating to Jacob here. So numerous and prosperous that they would be able to do such a thing. And so more than 14 years later, after going to Laban's house and serving him and marrying Leah and Rachel, Jacob began a journey back to his homeland or to where his family was. And he returned to the same location of Bethel, this place where God, again, he would expound upon the promise that he gave to Jacob. And this is found in chapter 35 and verse 11, where God said to him, "I am God, God Almighty, be fruitful and multiply." And he said, "A nation and a company of nations shall proceed from you. Kings shall come from your body, in other words, from your DNA, your descendants, your progeny. So, while working for Laban, God spoke to Jacob during his years of service, and he actually told Laban in chapter 31, I won't go there, but chapter 31 and verse 13, God told him that I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed the pillar and where you made a vow to me. And so Jacob, he anointed the pillar, he poured oil upon it, and he spoke to God. He vowed that he would be faithful to God as long as God took care of him, that he would be faithful to his moral law, that he would tithe the tenth of his increase. And so the stone, I think, became symbolic of this, of God's promise to Jacob, and perhaps also of God's vow to God. Jacob's vow to God. And this has led to another term for this pillar stone. Some people refer to it as the stone of destiny. And we could see why it would receive that term, because Jacob's descendants, after this event, were destined to become great nations that would be led by a succession of kings, monarchy. And so let's go forward a bit now to Exodus chapter 17. Exodus 17. The reason that I'm talking about this subject today, I was asked several months ago to take a look at this subject, and I thought, you know, I'm going to take a deeper look at it. Somebody had some particular questions in mind about this stone, and I thought it would be an interesting message to review. Some of this might be, a little review for some people who have studied the subject, and perhaps I will offer a little bit more food for thought in the message today, because there are some things to consider that perhaps some people have not considered in the past. And many people have wondered about this stone, this pillar stone, this supposed stone of destiny. Where is it? Where is it today? Can it be located? Do we know where it's located? Is it, in fact, the stone of Scone that arrived on the shores of Ireland some 2,600 years ago? And since that time, it's been taken from Scotland to England in the 1200s, and then now it's back in Scotland, and I think 1996 it was brought back to that location. The stone of Scone, as it's called, has a long history of being considered the same one that Jacob had anointed with oil. Though there are numerous legends and folklore surrounding the stone that now sits alongside crown jewels, it's a national treasure to more than one nation, there is a pattern in all of these stories suggesting that the prophet Jeremiah traveled to Ireland along with Baruch, and he took with him one of Zedekiah's daughters, at least one of them, and possibly took with him Jacob's pillar stone. And so these tales that come from folklore, from legends, and even from traditional songs that have been handed down orally for centuries, they almost all point to the stone arriving on the shores of Northern Ireland somewhere around 600 BC. And the tales are numerous. Sifting through them would be quite a task. I have not done the work. I have reviewed the work done by others. But they're quite often very similar. I mean, the names of people may change depending on what story you're reading. The situation might change a bit, but the outcomes seem to all be alike. And though many people would think, well, because there are so many tales and legends about these people and this stone, they would think that the variances disprove the legitimacy of the Stone of Scone. Others feel that the continual pattern actually gives it more credibility, that it is actually the stone Jacob had anointed. So Jacob's pillar stone did or does exist. We understand that. And There is symbolism to the stone, though, and many of us understand the symbolism, the stone being symbolic of Christ, and we read that frequently in the Bible, that Christ is portrayed as a rock or as a stone. He is called the chief cornerstone, the rock of Israel, whose work is perfect, who begot Israel, actually, out of Egypt. He is called the spiritual rock that followed them, the rock of salvation, and he is even called a stumbling block or rock of offense to some people, that is. You know, not to everyone, but to some people, his doctrine was offensive, a stumbling block for them. Now, in a prophetic blessing that Jacob gave to Joseph, Jacob called Christ the Messiah, our God, the shepherd stone of Israel. Now, Christ came from Judah, though. He did not come from the lineage of Joseph through Ephraim or Manasseh. He was a descendant of Judah. And so it could be that the prophecy, the prophetic blessing that Jacob gave to Joseph, was actually referring to the pillar, to Bethel, to the place where God made this promise, reiterated this promise to Jacob. And in fact, when you look at the mapping, the area of Bethel became an area that was within the borders of Ephraim, who received Joseph's birthright blessing. So that could make sense. This leads, though, to the question that I had posed is, you know, if the stone might have been taken from Bethel, if in fact Jacob removed it and carried it to Laban's, or perhaps picked it back up after leaving 14 years of service in Laban's house, did he take it with him, with his entourage, carry it around for years? Well, there's no mention of the stone being with Jacob while serving Laban. It doesn't say that he picked it up along the way or that he took it with him after his sons were born, when they traveled back down to Egypt, when Joseph called them to come back down, and when they established the 12 sons, the tribes in Egypt, when Joseph was second in command of the entire nation of Egypt. There's no stating that the stone was with them. But it doesn't mean, of course, that does not mean that it was not brought with them. But the point is we really don't have anything indicating that it was, so we don't have any evidence necessarily to point to. And so the question becomes then, what about when the people of Israel left Egypt? What about, you know, when God brought them out through miracles, through the plagues, when he brought them through the sea? Because some believe that there is evidence that they had Jacob's pillar stone with them when they wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. And the belief comes, one of the scriptures that some point to is Exodus 17. And this is the miracle of water, God bringing water out of a rock. And some believe this was Jacob's pillar stone. So let's look at the account just for a moment. Exodus 17, verse 1, all the congregation of the children of Israel set out on their journey from the wilderness of Sin, according to the commandment of the Eternal, and camped in Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. And therefore the people contended with Moses and said, give us water that we may drink. And so Moses said to them, why do you contend with me? Why do you tempt the Eternal? And the people thirsted there for water. And the people complained against Moses and said, why is it you have brought us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? And so Moses cried out to the Eternal, saying, what shall I do with this people? They are almost ready to stone me. And the Eternal said to Moses, go on before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel, and also take in your hand your rod with which you struck the river, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock in Horeb, and you will strike the rock, and water will come out of it that the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. So it is thought by some that this place where God said for Moses to go and stand there at the rock in Horeb, that this, he was speaking of Jacob's pillar stone, and that Moses struck the pillar stone and water came out. And the reason for some for this belief does not come from this scripture alone. People will pair with this scripture a statement by the Apostle Paul that in 1 Corinthians 10 and verses 1 through 4, and you do not need to turn there, I'm just going to read that, where he said, "I don't want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. All ate the same spiritual food," speaking of the manna, "and all drank the same spiritual drink. For they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ." And so some believe that this is both symbolic and literal, that the rock that followed them, they believe, was Jacob's pillar stone, and that pillar stone represented Christ. And through the miracles that God performed for the people of Israel, they were taken care of, but it was related to the pillar. However, the spiritual rock portraying Christ, is it an actual stone that they carried? Is it a stone that they brought out of Egypt with them? Now, it's not far-fetched, obviously, to think that it is, and perhaps it is, but there are some problems with the scenario, such a scenario. First, it could be that the rock is purely symbolic, that it indicates that Christ took care of them in the wilderness. He gave them food. He gave them water to drink. And he did this supernaturally, spiritually, in other words. That's why it says spiritual food and spiritual drink. And so the second possible difficulty is the logistics of this. Because if the coronation stone, the stone of Scone that is in Scotland today, if it is in fact Jacob's pillar stone, that stone, that rock, it weighs 335 pounds. So this would not have been necessarily such an easy thing for somebody to cart around with them. It wouldn't have been easy for Jacob to bring it from Bethel to Laban's, or from after he left from there, wherever he went, to carry it around. It wouldn't have been an easy thing for the people of Israel to cart around in the wilderness for 40 years. It wouldn't have been easy to, you know, keep track of it, to store it in the land of Egypt. But it is all possible. It's possible that, in fact, this did take place. But if you think about it, it also, and I don't know if any of you have tried to move 330 pounds. It's not easy. It would not have been such an easy thing for Jeremiah and Baruch to take with them thousands of miles from the Middle East, whether through the Mediterranean Sea on a boat or if they perhaps went on foot. It would have been quite cumbersome to take such a thing all the way to Northern Ireland. Still, it is possible. So we can't discount it just because it would have been difficult. Third, a rock of this size, and this is something just my own thoughts, and much of this I think is my own thinking, but I have done a lot of research on looking at the work of others. So a rock of this size, a rock of such importance that would have been of such importance, such as Jacob's pillar stone, something to have been had a great value in the mind of Israel, it seems to me that something like that would have been included in the narrative, that there would be some mention of it somewhere in the story and not just kind of a vague reference to some rock. Now consider, if you will, the mention about Joseph's bones. I mean, this is something that Joseph made Israel promise that they would take his bones with them when they left one day. And it's even recorded in Exodus 13 and verse 19 that Moses took the bones of Joseph with him because he had placed them under an oath and he wanted his bones taken up from there. And it's symbolic. And I gave a sermon about that several weeks ago about what the symbolism of taking his bones out of Egypt meant. And so there's symbolism and it's all helpful, I think, to us. But arguably, perhaps more important than Joseph's bones would have been Jacob's pillar stone, of what it represented, of the covenant that God would made with Jacob that was going to be fulfilled through his progeny. And so it seems to me that it should or would have been mentioned somewhere that this is Jacob's stone, this is the pillar that, you know, he had anointed. Something would indicate that it would was taken with them out of Egypt. Let's go over to Isaiah 48 for just a moment. Isaiah 48. Another point to consider about this particular miracle in Horeb, that is, where God told Moses to strike the rock there in Horeb, is that the phrasing of that event, of what took place and what God instructed Moses to do beforehand, it seems to be that this rock in Horeb was a landmark. And it wasn't something that the people had carried with them, but it was actually something that was notable in the landscape. And so Moses would have known exactly what God is talking about. Now, there have been numerous, and it's definitely not in the hundreds, not even probably 100, but there have been probably a dozen or more outings in Saudi Arabia that actually have seemed to have located that rock in Horeb. And most of us have seen pictures of that unique rock formation. It has an enormous boulder sticking out of the ground in the air some six stories high. There's nothing like it for dozens of miles around. And it's in very close proximity to where Mount Sinai likely is located. And so on top of that, there is erosion around the base of this six-story-high rock that is it's water erosion, and it's not just from sprinkles over the years in a desert that gets very little rainfall. It seems to indicate that hundreds and thousands of gallons of water were moving around the bottom of this rock at some point in time. Now, consider a few other scriptures that speak of this location. Isaiah 48, verse 21 says, "Did they not thirst when God led them through the deserts? He caused the waters to flow from the rock for them." And then it says, "He also split the rock, and waters gushed out." And so this rock that people have located in Saudi Arabia is split. From top to bottom, a six-story-high rock is split down the middle. And so it seems that this is the actual location. And if this was referring to Jacob's pillar stone, well, it would have been split at some point. Perhaps it was larger at one time, which would make it, you know, some 700 pounds or more. In any case, another scripture, Psalm 78:15, and you don't have to turn there, it says that he split the rocks in the wilderness and gave them drink in abundance, like the depths. And so, of course, that would fit very well with an area where it appears that hundreds of thousands of gallons of water were just gushing out for an extended period of time. In Psalm 105 and verse 36, it says, "He destroyed the firstborn in the land of Egypt, the first of all their strength. He brought them out with silver and gold. There was none feeble among his tribes. Egypt was glad when they departed. Fear had fallen upon them. He spread a cloud covering and gave them light in the night. The people asked. He brought quail. He satisfied them with bread from heaven." And then it says, "He opened the rock and water gushed out, and it ran in the dry places like a river." And of course, that again would fit this location that has been discovered in Saudi Arabia. And so it is believed that the six-story tall rock in Horeb is this rock that was mentioned in Exodus 17 and verse 6, I believe. So it doesn't seem likely that that particular event was Jacob's pillar stone. And I just wanted to throw it out there because some people will point to that scripture and say, "There's the pillar stone." And it doesn't seem like that is the case. But there is another example. There is another example of water coming out of a rock that is more inconclusive in my mind. And we can go over there and look at that for a moment. Numbers in chapter 20. Numbers 20. Another incident of water coming out of a rock. And this took place long after the rock in Horeb account. Numbers 20, in verse 2, it says, "There was no water for the congregation." This is after Miriam, Moses' sister, had died. Said there was no water for the congregation. And so they gathered together against Moses and Aaron, and people contended with Moses and spoke, saying, "If only we had died when our brethren died before the Eternal." And I think this is an indication of that this took place much later, because God said that all those, you know, above a certain age were going to die in the wilderness, and their children would go into the promised land. So here they're saying, "If only we had died when our brethren died before the Eternal. Why have you brought up the assembly of the Eternal into this wilderness that we and our animals should die here? And why have you made us come out of Egypt to bring us to this evil place? It is not a place of grain or figs or vines or pomegranates, nor is there any water to drink." And so Moses, he went from the presence of the assembly to the door of the tabernacle of meeting, and they fell on their faces, and the glory of the Eternal appeared to them. And then the Eternal spoke to Moses and said, "Take the rod, you and your brother Aaron, gather the congregation together. Speak to the rock before their eyes, and it will yield its water. Thus you shall bring water for them out of the rock, and give drink to the congregation and their animals." And so Moses took the rod from before the Eternal, as he had commanded him. And Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly together before the rock and said to them, "Hear now, you rebels, must we bring water from out of this rock?" And Moses lifted his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod, and water came out abundantly, and the congregation and their animals drank. So some people will point to this event and say that here's Jacob's pillar stone, the rock that Moses struck. It's not the rock in Horeb. It's a different place. This took place in an area called Kadesh. The wilderness here in this location, it's the name of the wilderness is Zin, which is the Hebrew Tsin. It's pronounced like T-S-E-E-N. It's similar but different to the wilderness of Sin, which is the Hebrew Tsin without the T at the front. Similar, notably different, though. The phrasing, though, seems to indicate, if you read it, it seems to indicate that Moses knew exactly what rock God was referring to. Now, again, it could be another landmark. You could say, well, this is a landmark in the area. Perhaps it was a rock that, you know, was near the tabernacle of meeting, or maybe this was a rock that Moses had went to kneel down to and pray at times. It's possible that God was talking to, also it's possible that God was talking about a familiar stone that they had carried around with them for 40 years. And of course, this would fit quite well with the legend that the rock was kept by Jacob, passed down for the coronation of kings for the last 2,600 years after it arrived on the shores of Ireland. But again, it's not definitive, so all we can do is speculate about that. And so let's look at something else to consider. 2 Kings, the book of 2 Kings, in chapter 11. There is a bit of evidence that at least one king was coronated near a pillar, and perhaps a pillar that was associated with Bethel, meaning house of God. And the prophet Nathan actually told David that God will make you a house. And the context of Nathan's words to David was establishing David as a royal dynasty, a monarchy that would continue unto Christ's return. And so God promised that David's descendants would sit on a continual throne. And that throne is called the throne of the eternal. Or you could translate it the house of God, because it was a throne that God had established to serve his purposes. And so David's monarchy obviously was not his alone. It was a type of God's house. And of course, that's the definition of Bethel. And so the pillar stone of Jacob seems to fit that symbolism perfectly. A house or a dynasty, you know, established by God. So because a pillar is a structural support, it is another fitting expression for Christ, isn't it? And we had already talked about that briefly. Christ, who is called a rock, who is called a chief cornerstone, a foundation of the house of God, as Paul said, which is the church of the living God, a pillar of ground and of truth. And so Christ is the foundation of that. And even though his doctrine has always been and will always be structurally sound, Christ was the stone that the builders rejected during his ministry. And so this has even led some to speculate, and I just thought it was interesting, but some speculate that the pillar that Jacob had used, that he came across and that he had used, was actually a stone, or could actually have been a stone that was previously cut out, quarried from someone to use in some sort of building, but the quarryman rejected it for perceived flaws that it may have had. And of course that would fit, you know, with stone, with Christ being the rock or stone or pillar that was rejected. But the flaws were not really there. They were just perceived flaws. But is there evidence that Jacob's pillar stone was taken and it was used for coronation in the Bible? Well, one of the scriptures that some go to is in 2 Kings and verse 12. This is after the death of Athaliah, and or during. And it says, when she looked, when Athaliah looked, there was the king standing by a pillar according to custom. And the leaders and the trumpeters were by the king, and all the people of the land were rejoicing and blowing trumpets. And so Athaliah tore her clothes and cried out, "Treason, treason!" But Jehoiada the priest commanded the captains and officers of the army and said to them, "Take her outside under guard and go on." In any case, basically this person is being ordained king here, but she was against it. They did not want this, some did not want this to take place, but it says that this individual stood by a pillar according to custom. Now, of course, the question is, well, what pillar? Was this Jacob's pillar, the stone that he had brought out of Bethel? Well, it doesn't say, so we don't know. It could be. That could be the case, but it might not be either. There's no indication. There's nobody pointing out, stood by Jacob's pillar where God's promise had made, nothing indicating that it was that pillar if it was even taken out of Bethel. So when she looked, and she, 2 Chronicles 23, verse 13, you don't have to turn there, but that's another account, and it actually says basically the same thing, where it says that she looked, and there was the king standing by his pillar at the entrance. And so let's go over to 2 Kings 23 for a moment to look at another event that some have used to say that here's Jacob's pillar. 2 Kings 23 and verse 3. This is the account of Josiah, who was one of Israel's greatest kings. He had many reforms. He restored much in the land of Judah. And he stood by a pillar, it says. The king stood by a pillar and made a covenant before the Eternal to follow the Eternal and to keep his commandments and his testimonies and statutes with all his heart and all his soul, to perform the words of this covenant that were written in this book. And all the people took a stand for the covenant. So it seems, you know, it's kind of similar to what Jacob had done. Jacob had set up a pillar and he made a vow to God that he would be his God and that he would keep his commandments and he would tithe. And so it's similar to what Josiah had done in this account. And the pillar mentioned, of course, again, it doesn't say it was Jacob's pillar. It doesn't say it was a stone of destiny or anything, or that even that it was a pillar of great significance. But of all the kings of Israel and Judah, we see that if they were all coronated on a particular pillar, these are the only two accounts we have of a pillar being near to a king or associated to a king when they were coronated. And even when Samuel had went and anointed David to become Israel's king, there was no pillar involved. At least it doesn't say there was a pillar involved. And so my point is not to try to discount the fact that Jacob's pillar may still exist, that it might be in Scotland. It's just I don't think we can actually use those scriptures and say, there it is. There's Jacob's pillar. When it may be, maybe it's not. Nonetheless, anointing kings upon a pillar stone became a tradition of the Irish, the Scottish, the English people, of their monarchies for more than 2,000 years. And the tradition that these people have taken, it is based upon biblical text. That those people looked at the biblical text and they understood who they were in regards to the promise that was made to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, that was fulfilled through the tribe of Ephraim. They understood that they were and are people of Israel. That they are descendants, not just of Israel, but specifically also that their monarchy consists of descendants of King David. And so this tradition, based upon biblical text, has led to this stone of Scone that many believe is Jacob's pillar stone. And it's possible that that is the stone that Jacob had anointed. And let's go into this a little bit deeper, into Jeremiah chapter 1. I've really tried to break a lot of this down to make it simple. It actually, the subject can be much more complicated than I'm stating today. But I've tried to just look at pretty much just the essentials of the information that we have. Because the folklore surrounding the stone of Scone in Scotland is that Jeremiah fled and that he took with him Baruch and at least one of the daughters of King Zedekiah, and he also took Jacob's pillar stone. And part of this story is based upon legends, upon songs, stories that have been handed down orally from in the Irish, Scottish, and English people over centuries. But there is some biblical truth to some of this. There is some truth to the account, to the belief that Jeremiah may have went to the shores of Northern Ireland with Baruch and a daughter of Zedekiah. So Jeremiah's commission as a prophet was stated to him early on, of course. In Jeremiah 1, verse 10, it indicates that his ministry, if you will, was going to be more than just public speaking. That he would be actively involved, participating, making a real physical effort. And so look at what God said to Jeremiah here in verse 10. He said, See, I have this day set you over the nations and over kingdoms to root out, to pull down, to destroy, and to throw down, also to build and to plant. And so Jeremiah is often associated with lament, with grief and just woe. But it also says that he would be over a form of building. In a form of planting. And so Jeremiah, he was a prophet sent primarily to Judah, But his influence, it was foretold, God told him that his influence would be upon many other people. His influence would be on other nations, other kingdoms. He would have a part to play, yes, in rooting out and in throwing down or in some of the destruction that would come, but also to build and to plant. And so the destruction, some of the destruction may have been fulfilled when, you know, when Judah was taken over by the Chaldeans, invaded by Nebuchadnezzar. But there are dualities in some of that for nations to come. But the building and the planting part actually may have been through this, what has been referred to as a legend, of him taking one of the daughters of King Zedekiah to another land. And in this land, one of these daughters would be instrumental in maintaining a dynasty of King David for more than 2,000 years. So according to Numbers 27, and you do not need to turn there, but Numbers 27 indicates that a daughter can be considered the inheritor of her father's birthright. If there was no man to take over, no son to have this handed down to him, that the daughter actually would be a legitimate way for the birthright to be passed on. And this would include a royal lineage. King Zedekiah, after Judea was invaded by Babylon, and Jerusalem specifically, King Zedekiah had his sons, who would have been the heirs to the throne, killed before his very eyes. And then his eyes were put out by King Nebuchadnezzar. The king was then taken away as a prisoner to Babylon, and he would later die in that location. Now, shortly after the invasion, and I don't know the exact time period, but it wasn't long after the invasion, there was a remnant in Judah who had escaped being taken prisoner. They had escaped death. And this remnant included King Zedekiah's daughters. And they went with an individual by the name of Johanan to Egypt, where they escaped, or you can call it escape, but protected, I guess, might be a better term. They were protected for a time in a place called Tapanhes. And I don't know if that's correct in pronunciation, but it's called Tapanhes. Now, these people, this remnant, they were actually, even though they were protected, some of them, I should say, were protected in this place, most were not, because God told them not to go. He said, don't go there. He said, stay. Stay here in Judah, and I'll protect you. And Jeremiah related this to those people. But they didn't want to stay. Perhaps they were too afraid. Maybe they didn't believe Jeremiah. You would think they would believe this prophet by then. But in any case, they chose to go to Egypt. And they took these people with them. Now, some were protected. Most of them actually died by the sword in the land of Egypt. Some were protected. And actually, Jeremiah and Baruch were two of the individuals that were taken. They didn't want to go either because God said don't go. But they were forced to go to Egypt. And so it is that God allowed this because God also said in Jeremiah 44, in verse 28, he said, yet a small number who escaped the sword in Egypt shall return from the land of Egypt to the land of Judah. So he indicated that a very small, of the remnant that went, that a smaller number even would survive. Now, there is actually extra biblical, historical, and archaeological evidence that Egypt did protect these daughters for a time. There was an ancient fortress that was discovered in 1886 in the area that was once known as Tapanhes. And this fortress, this place, was known as Kasar bint el Yehude. And basically, I don't know how to pronounce that exactly, but what the name means is Palace of the Jews' Daughters. Now, it's interesting because they could have used a different term, which is similar to Kasar. It's something different, which just means Place of the Jews' Daughters, but they did not. They used Palace of the Jews' Daughters, and I think that they used this term because this was a place where royalty had lived for a time. Even if they were in hiding, the King Zedekiah's daughters were considered part of the royal line. But the question is, where did they go? Where did they go from this location? Well, Egypt had invaded Babylon, likely because, well, at least part of the reason, because these daughters were taken by the Egyptians, or at least protected in the land of the Egyptians. And so it seems that Nebuchadnezzar had his mind set on stamping out the line of David, which maybe he only knew it as the line of Zedekiah. But in any case, that area was invaded and some escaped. And it's possible, and in my mind, I think likely, that Jeremiah had the role of protecting at least one of these daughters, taking her out of that place, out of harm's way, to a place far away. Whether he traveled through the Mediterranean, all the way around, up through the Celtic Sea, it's not known exactly what, it seems like that would have been the location if the legend is true, that he arrived on the shores of Northern Ireland, that would have been the route. But he would have taken, if this is the case, he would have taken one of these daughters to a land where Israelites already lived. That the people, the native people of Ireland, and now found in Scotland and also in England, that these people actually are descendants of Israel. And it's fairly complicated, and I'm not going to go into it, but there are many papers that are written, or books that have been written on the subject, like Judah's Scepter and Joseph's Birthright, United States and Britain in Prophecy, and a paper that I'm going to quote in just a moment, written by Tom Robinson. In any case, this would have been an area where Israelites had been living for quite some time, and they would find safety there. And in this location, they would be able to thrive, and also the lineage of David would survive. And it's interesting, of course, when we look at the history of these people, that they have long had kings, even to this day, that have been the primary form of leadership. So Ireland, Scotland, and England are rich with history and tradition, indicating that they are, in fact, descendants of Israel and descendants of David. They have symbolism in the coat of arms that include a lion, pointing to the Lion of Judah, and even a harp, pointing to the fact that David was a musician. There are various peoples or tribes with various names that are related to the people of Israel, such as the Danites and the Miletians and others. And it appears that their history goes back to before the Assyrian invasion of the House of Israel, the Northern Kingdom, and obviously then before the Babylonian invasion of Judah. And so the people of Israel migrated even before that took place. And I think this is likely the case. Now, notice something that Tom Robinson wrote, and this is going to be examining a prophecy by the prophet Ezekiel. Now, Ezekiel, he was a contemporary prophet with Jeremiah, and in fact, many of his prophecies, it is believed, were recorded after Judah was already taken captive. And one of his prophecies, I think, helps to fill in some of the details about what God did, how he caused the line of David to survive even to this day, because he promised David that your descendant of yours will be sitting on a continual throne. And so he wrote this, Tom Robinson wrote, "Prior to Jerusalem's fall, Ezekiel posed a riddle to the house of Israel." And again, that's interesting, not to Judah. The house of Israel had been dissolved almost a century prior. But yet this riddle that Ezekiel gave was to the house of Israel. So he explained this, what the prophecy or the riddle meant in the same chapter. And here's how it goes. He says, "A great eagle came to Lebanon and took from the cedar the highest branch." And the meaning of this is explained. The king of Babylon went to Jerusalem and took its king and its princes, the highest branch. Then he cropped off the top of his young twigs, meaning that he took the king's offspring. Having explained these symbols, God, through Ezekiel, gave the following parable. He said, I will also take a twig or sprig of the highest branches, which is Zedekiah and his princes, and of the high cedar, which is Judah, referring symbolically of Judah, and set it out, and I will crop off from the topmost of its young twigs, the young twigs referring to Zedekiah's children, a tender one, and this is likely a reference to a female, and will plant it on a high and prominent mountain, a great kingdom, on the mountain height, top of the kingdom, top of the throne, of Israel. He's planting it on the top of Israel, not of Judah, but of Israel. I will plant it, I will bring forth boughs and bear fruit, and it will be a majestic cedar. Under it will dwell birds of every sort. And what has happened through Great Britain, the kingdom of Great Britain? And it will dwell birds of every sort. They have been a blessing to nations all around the world, all manners of peoples. And of all the trees of the field, which can be referencing nations of the earth, shall I know the Eternal has brought down the high tree, Judah, and exalted the low tree, Israel. And so Judah, the house of Israel, was brought down. And eventually the house of Judah, and eventually the house of Israel was raised up. So here, I think, could be what the latter part of Jeremiah's commission was about, which we had read in Jeremiah 1 and verse 10, about building, about planting, about a continuation of David's dynasty in Ireland through a marriage of one of King Zedekiah's daughters to an Israelite leader that would already have been established in the region. Now, the name Ireland, and again, this is a reminder to some of us, the name Ireland is itself a telling expression. It's a shortened term of a name going back to the 6th century BC, supposedly back to the 6th century, which is Jeremy's land. And we can see where that came from, Jeremy or Jeremiah's land, hence the shortened term Ireland. So Jeremiah, obviously, he did not found that land. There were people there already living there when he would have came. But he would have had a huge part to play in helping to establish Ireland as a prominent nation, which would become Scotland and which would become England. And so the folklore of Ireland and Scotland say that Jeremiah took one of the king's daughters along with Baruch and Jacob's pillar stone to the shores of northern Ireland. Now the names of these people that I had just mentioned, Jeremiah, Baruch, and King Zedekiah's daughter, the names will change. They vary depending on what version of the story that you are hearing. But the tale calls one of them the lawgiver, and the other male a secretary, and the female a princess. And of course, all of those terms would fit with Jeremiah, which would be a lawgiver, not the lawgiver, but an enforcer of the law, Baruch being a secretary, and then, of course, one of King Zedekiah's daughters being a princess. So the folklore has been handed down orally for more than 2,000 years, and the stories vary. We have to be honest, the stories actually have several discrepancies, but there is much evidence in the history of Ireland and Scotland and England that, in fact, their monarchs are descendants of Israel, descendants of King David as well. And this would, of course, fit very well with God's promise to David that he would have one of his descendants sitting upon a continual throne over Israel. And so we understand that the people of Great Britain can be attributed and are the people of Ephraim. Ephraim received Joseph's birthright blessing, or I should say Jacob gave them Joseph's birthright blessing, and that he said, my name will be upon them. And that would fit, of course, God's purpose and what he had planned to do. So the question I began with in this study is, did Jeremiah bring Jacob's pillar stone on a long journey from Judea to northern Europe? Well, it is possible that this did take place, but it's also, we have to be entirely honest, it's also possible that the stone of Scoon is not the same one that Jacob had anointed. It's possible that some zealot in Ireland, well-intended, may have, you know, understanding their heritage, I think their heritage is true, but understanding that, wanted something more tangible. And so somebody may have decided to, we're gonna carve out a stone, and we're going to say this is Jacob's pillar stone, a large, rectangular, more than 300-pound stone, and call it Jacob's pillar, or the stone of Scoon is what many call it today. Archaeological and geological investigations into the stone conclude different things. I have read that some who have examined it say that there is no similar rock formation in the British Isles, and of course that would mean it came from somewhere else. Others have said that the stone could have been quarried from an area near to Scoon that has similar rock deposits, and that is a possibility. One report said it's the same type of sandstone that can be found near to Bethel. And Tom Robinson, I think, put it this way, and he did much more research than I did on the subject. His conclusion was, there's just no way to be sure either way. But the question then becomes, does it have to be? Do we need it to be Jacob's pillar stone in order for God's promise to be legitimate, in order for God to fulfill his prophecy, in order for it to be true? You know, must we have a physical rock showing us that God had done these things, that it's evidence of David's throne preserved through the people of Great Britain? Or are the people alone enough? What those people have done, as God prophesied, is that enough? You know, my conclusion is we don't need to have a physical rock pointing us at the true God, that what he said is true, showing us that those are his people and we are his people. We don't need an actual rock to validate God or to validate us. And so let's look at Isaiah chapter 51 for a moment. Isaiah 51. In the early 1930s, Herbert Armstrong began what I might call an epic venture into establishing one of the greatest eras of God's church. It began very small, and it began with high hopes and a lot of prayer. Mr. Armstrong documented much of this in his autobiography, and I'm going to read a small section of one part. When some of these early arrangements were being made, he wrote, "As soon as arrangements were completed for starting the new church at Salem, I hurried on down to the Fisher Farm to start the new campaign west of Eugene. Mr. Oberg was starting his new meetings in Harrisburg on Sunday night, July 9th. The Fishers and I decided to start the meetings at the Fir Butte School the same night. I arrived," and this isn't Sabbath meetings, this was just meetings discussing establishing the church in this area. "I arrived at the Fisher Farm, leaving my wife and children at our home in Salem about July 5th or 6th. This was the small, actually infinitesimal start of what was destined to grow to a major worldwide gospel work reaching multiple millions of people every week. But if small, It started with a burst of energy and inspiration. First, it started with intensive and earnest private prayer. To the rear of the Fisher Farm home was a fair-sized hill. Running over this hilltop for exercise, I discovered a rock about 14 inches high. It was in a secluded spot. It came to mind how Jesus had dismissed the multitudes and gone up into a mountain apart to pray alone with God. I dropped to my knees before this rock, which seemed just the right height to kneel before, and I began to pray earnestly for the success of the meetings. It became sort of a daily pilgrimage during my stay at the Fishers to this, which became my prayer rock. I'm sure that I drank in much energy, a spiritual strength and inspiration at that prayer rock. Similar to Jacob's pillar stone, this rock was a tool. It's just a physical thing. Nothing of real great value or perhaps even of importance, but it was something that was used by a man God was working with, and he used it to perhaps better connect to God. But was the rock necessary? Did Mr. Armstrong need that rock to be there? Would God have been unable to work with Mr. Armstrong if he would not have stumbled across this rock that he called a prayer rock? And a similar question is, would God have been unable to fulfill his promise to Jacob, to fulfill his promise to David, if the pillar stone were not located, if he didn't take it out of Bethel? Well, of course not. God declares that he's going to do something, and he's going to do it, no matter what. He doesn't need something physical to make sure that it takes place, except unless you want to talk about the people, the physical people that he worked with. But some people, they put a lot of value into physical things that might be connected to God, might be connected to God, people God has worked with over the years. And today, the Stone of Scone, it is under the protection of the Scottish government. There are armed guards protecting it. It's considered a national treasure, not just to Scotland, but to Ireland and to England as well. England's kind of said it's on loan. We're going to need it back one day, and we're going to need to use it occasionally. But what about Mr. Armstrong's prayer rock? What became of it? Is it of great value? In a booklet titled The New Throne of David, a minister wrote this: Mr. Todd found the former Fisher Farm. He walked over the whole area and examined it closely, and there was only one rock that could have been Mr. Armstrong's prayer rock. Remarkably, its dimensions were precisely as Mr. Armstrong had described. In April of 2002, Mr. Todd took me on a tour of the sites of Mr. Armstrong's early days in the work. When I saw the prayer rock, I said it was the most inspiring rock I've seen, second only after the Stone of Scone. We thought that the rock was something we ought to have. We were going to hold off getting it until we could do a little filming there, but Mr. Todd said that someone else was trying to get it, and so we hurried along. We offered to purchase the rock, but the man who owned the property gave it to us free of charge. We brought it to our headquarters and put it on display. God wanted us to have this rock. The Bible has many examples of God using stones for special purposes. A stone is tangible, and here we have something that I think is supremely precious to God. I believe God gave it to us because we honor Mr. Armstrong and believe in what he did. It is meaningful to us because it is a tangible symbol of the infinitesimal beginning of the work of God in our age, the greatest work ever on earth in terms of the impact and number of people reached. And for this reason, the prayer rock holds great significance to God's people. Surely God's had something important in mind. I now see that God was behind those events, and for a very important reason. Mr. Armstrong's prayer rock has replaced the stone of destiny. has it. In a sermon given by this minister, he said, "We have the new throne of David and the new stone of destiny." And he said, "That's putting us in pretty close proximity to God." But does it really? Do physical items that we might possess, you know, possible relics of another time or a piece of property of a faithful person that God had used in the past, would those things put us in close proximity to God? Or is it something else? Is it the behaviors? Is it the humility? Is it the obedience found in the faithfulness to God that puts us, a man or a woman, in close proximity to Him? I suggest the latter is the case. And I think we know that because Jacob's pillar stone is real. It was a literal rock, or is a literal stone. Jacob spoke to God. Jacob anointed a rock during this pivotal point in his life. But do we need to have the stone of Scone in Scotland? Does that have to be that very stone in order for God to be true, in order for the Bible to reveal? Does God need it? Does He need that stone? He doesn't. He doesn't have to have Jacob's literal stone sitting in the British Isles in order for His word to be fulfilled. And so neither do we need to have a prayer rock, something used a long time ago to be in our possession in order to be considered one of God's people, in order to be on God's radar, if you will. We have all that we need, everything that we need. The rock that led Israel on a journey to the promised land was God's anointed. It was Christ. The rock leading us on our journey to the kingdom of God is that same spiritual rock that followed them. And that rock was Christ. And that is what we look to. Isaiah 51 and verse 1. "Listen to me, you who follow after righteousness, you who seek the eternal. Look to the rock from which you were hewn, and to the hole of the pit from which you were dug." And then it goes on to say, "Look to Abraham your father and to Sarah who bore you." Why? Why look to Abraham their father or to Sarah? Why consider them? Because of their faithfulness. That's why. Do those things that they did. I mean, Genesis 26 and verse 5 says that God did these things. Why? Because Abraham obeyed my voice. Abraham kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. And so, yes, prayer can be a powerful, powerful thing. But I suggest its potential is reached through righteousness, through the behavior of those who are praying to God. And so what is righteousness? Well, we have a definition right here in the Bible. Is it having a prayer rock? Is it the stone of Scone? Is that righteousness? No, it's the great God. God's commandments define righteousness. He is the creator of those commandments. And it even says in Deuteronomy 6, verse 25, it says, "Then it will be righteousness for us if we are careful to observe all these commandments." And it also says in the New Testament, the effective and fervent prayer of a righteous man or woman avails much. And in return, God will consider us. We look to Him, keep His commandments, and God will also consider us. As it says later in Isaiah, and I don't have to turn there, Isaiah 66:2, "On this one will I look, on him or her who is of poor and of a contrite spirit and who trembles at my word." And so this is how we maintain our connection to God. This is how we are in close proximity to Him. Through prayer, through supplication, through keeping His commandments. And so focus on the rock and pillar that is the reality of whatever any of those things might symbolize, the rock of salvation. Jesus Christ. Keep the commandments of God and don't get mixed up in, you know, fables or commandments of men. Overcome the ways of this world. That is what God is looking to. That is what God wants, to see how we are going to follow his law, to see how righteous we can be by keeping his law. And if we do, Christ will one day coronate you as a king of his temple.